What's up, everybody? My name is Dimitri Kafinas, and you're listening to Hidden Forces, a podcast that inspires investors, entrepreneurs, and everyday citizens to challenge consensus narratives and to learn how to think critically about the systems of power shaping our world. My guest in today's episode is Shehzad Kazi, the managing director of China Beigebook, which operates a private, in-country data collection network developed to track the Chinese marketplace, gathering real-time economic data from thousands of firms across all of China's regions, sectors, and 34 discrete industries. The company's CEO, Leland Miller, was my guest for an episode recorded during the height of the COVID-19 pandemic in the spring of 2020. And we had a chance then to talk about the impact of the global economic shutdown on the Chinese economy, as well as the implications for its banking system, which has been a persistent source of embedded weakness for the country's long-term economic growth prospects. We also discussed some of the geopolitical consequences that could potentially flow from the ongoing global disruptions caused by the pandemic and the effects on China's highly levered real estate market. Today's conversation with Shehzad picks up where that episode left off, with the Chinese economy's long-awaited reopening potentially picking up steam as the U.S. and Europe possibly teeter on the edge of recession. The health of the Chinese economy remains the predominant demand variable driving the market's expectations for inflation and commodity prices globally. I asked Shehzad to share with us what he and his team are seeing in terms of growth expectations for 2023 and why markets seem to be having such a difficult time pricing the risks associated with China's COVID reopening and its effects on the prices of key commodities. We also discuss the ongoing impact of geopolitical tensions on global supply chains and the effects of recent export controls on China's semiconductor industry. This is the latest in a series of episodes we've published over the years on China's economy, its political system, and the challenges to U.S.-China relations. You can find other such related podcasts on this week's episode page at hiddenforces.io, where you can also access the second part of today's conversation by joining one of our three content tiers. This gives you access to our premium feed, which you can use to listen to the second part of today's conversation on your mobile device using your favorite podcast app, just like you're listening to this episode right now. If you want to join in on the conversation and become a member of the Hidden Forces Genius community, which includes Q&A calls with guests, access to special research and analysis, in-person events, and dinners, you can also do that on our subscriber page. And if you still have questions, feel free to send an email to info@hiddenforces.io, and I or someone from our team will get right back to you. And with that, please enjoy this illuminating conversation with my guest, Shehzad Kazi. Shehzad Kazi, welcome to Hidden Forces. I should say, welcome back to Hidden Forces. You were, well, not technically, but you did a recent live Q&A with our Hidden Forces Genius community about a week or so ago, right around the time that the Chinese GDP numbers came in. So kind of welcome back.
Hey, thanks. It's great to be back talking to you again.
So that was such a great conversation, and the community got so much out of it that I invited you to come back on and have a more full-throated conversation with me on the podcast. Before we get started, why don't you just tell our listeners, for those who aren't familiar with you or who didn't hear our episode with your CEO, Leland Miller, from a few years back that I mentioned in the introduction, tell us a little bit about who you are and what China Beigebook is.
Yeah, happy to do so. So I'm the managing director and as well as the chief operating officer of China Beigebook. CBB is a macroeconomic data and advisory company that's existed for about 12 years now. You know, our claim to fame, if you will, is that we're the only company in the entire world that has access to large-scale private data on the Chinese economy. We survey thousands of businesses in China over the course of the year, where we survey them every month, of course, covering every major sector of the economy. whether it be state firms, large firms, SMEs, private firms, and in every part of the Chinese economy, geographically, sectorally, and are able to walk away with a very unique set of data that nobody else on the planet has access to, and tell investors and tell corporate decision makers exactly what's going on in the world's second largest economy.
So how do you guys get your numbers? And the Chinese Communist Party is notoriously controlling when it comes to data. So how are you able to work around those constraints?
Yeah, the first thing is that, you know, we talk directly to the source and are able to access senior decision makers at these companies within China ourselves, rather than having to utilize any part or form of official data that come out of the NBS, which is typically what every other China macroeconomic firm out there does. Now, the truth is that we got into China, obviously, at a time where the market was a lot more open, which has given us that sort of first mover's advantage, if you will. But the other thing is that, look, we are at the end of the day driven by what the numbers say. And a lot of the commentary around China is driven by folks at times talking their book, to be very direct. We are not China bulls. We're not China bears. We are not here to sell an investment product. We're here to tell you exactly what's going on. And I think being sort of that third party impartial source goes a long way when it comes to working in a place like China, where at times political considerations will top any economic or policy considerations otherwise.
How do you judge the reliability of your data? And what is the margin for error that you, like, how does one think about margin for error when it comes to tracking Chinese economic data versus, let's say, data sets in the US and Europe?
Yeah, so I think a couple of things over there. First of all, you know, the fact is that ultimately what we are picking up should show up in a range of proxy indicators with a lag, of course, but it should, right? So, for example, if we are seeing a downturn in consumer spending in China, this will eventually begin to show up in the earnings statements of companies that are selling in China, whether it be Apple selling its iPhones, whether it be companies selling laptops, whether it be publicly traded companies who are selling luxury goods, if that is a market that is also affected, and so forth. If you're seeing any broader downturn in industrial activity, that you will ultimately see showing up in the prices of commodities, metals commodities, and oil, and so forth. So the whole idea is that you get this data ahead of time, which sets you up for when the market will ultimately react to it, when the numbers become obvious, regardless of what the government is saying. Now, to be completely fair, it is nuanced. It's not that the government's data are completely manipulated or always manipulated. They suffer from, at times, the same problems that a lot of government statistics do. They're lagged, they're incomplete, they are prone to serious revisions. So that those are the sorts of challenges that we try to get ahead of course. Now, the fact is that the margin of error ultimately on many Chinese data points is unknown because of the lack of transparency. I've gone through several cycles now where I have struggled with a lot of China data, especially the revisions that take place, but there's no way to reconcile them because the underlying numbers are simply not made available, making it very difficult for investors to ascertain just how much the economy may have improved, or, for example, where the sources of pain and stress are.
Yeah, also GDP numbers in China are actually targets, and they are politically important in a way that they aren't in the US, which I guess makes it even more difficult. It also makes sense that if you have a GDP target, you're going to want to hit it regardless of whether the data is accurate or not. But what's even more interesting to me is how you come in below target, which is what happened last year, and how exactly that sort of works. So how you think about how accurate the GDP numbers are, the official numbers are at least, when they come in below target. So talk to me a little bit about that. One, what was the GDP number last year? How far below target did it come in? And what do your numbers say? And how do they compare to official government statistics?
Yeah, the first thing you said is incredibly important. In China, the GDP number is a political number, not an economic number. It is a target. And, you know, typically speaking, provinces will have their own targets and are set to hit it. And what that means is that at the end of the day, you end up with this accounting. It's an accounting of economic activity, but it doesn't really tell you whether it's productive activity are not, because you could quite literally, and this does happen, you can move one excavator from one place to the next and back. You can dig a hole and refill it and dig it back up again and keep doing that till you hit your GDP target. So I always say this, that, you know, smart money will never chase GDP targets in China, because it's simply not the right way to invest or think about China-based investments. Now, what happened last year is an interesting example. The government set it in 2022, a target of 5.5%. They finally released the number coming in at 3% for the full year. Now, I think that 3% actually overstates economic growth in China, and by quite a bit. In reality, you know, we've done the work, and our economists, especially our chief economist, has done the work, and we estimate that it probably wasn't too much below 2%. One of the biggest problem areas, I think, in the GDP numbers for 2022 last year were that in the fourth quarter, the economy supposedly grew at 2.9% over the prior year. Now, that is incredibly baffling, and it's baffling for a handful of reasons, and I'll talk to you about how we look at it through the lens of our own proprietary numbers also. Just looking at the government's own data, we know for a fact that the PMIs that the government puts out were in contraction territory through all of the fourth quarter. As a matter of fact, the numbers contracted more and more in each successive month of the fourth quarter. If you look at things like exports, again, through customs data, exports were falling throughout in the fourth quarter. But then when you really get into private numbers, China Beige's private numbers, what do you see? You see a severe downturn across every leading indicator that we have. You see a massive year-over-year downturn across every sector, in every part of the country. It is very clear in the numbers, and we're talking about almost 4,500 companies that were surveyed over the course of the fourth quarter. When you look at the year-over-year comparison, it is a contraction. There's just no question about it. So I think when you take our private data, when you take some of the numbers that the government itself is putting out, it is incredibly difficult to walk away saying that the economy actually did better in the fourth quarter of 2022 than in the fourth quarter of 2021. The economy absolutely contracted. So GDP growth rate, as you can imagine, from a contraction being stated at 2.9%, that's a massive, massive overstatement. That is some serious data inflation and, quite frankly, data manipulation that is going on in the numbers there. So the Chinese economy today, as we get into 2023 and you think about the rebound and all that, is going to be coming off a very, very low base, much lower than the government has even accepted.
So one would expect that the Chinese service sector would have been most affected by the government's zero COVID measures, where as the industrial sector and areas of the economy that benefit most from demand for exports would presumably be less affected, with the exception of maybe labor shortages caused by intermittent lockdowns. In other words, it seems that demand from the rest of the world would have been a more important factor in contributing to the drop in year-over-year growth between Q4 2021 and Q4 2022. Is that a fair assumption to make? And if it is, if the drop in growth, in other words, is primarily a reflection of a slowdown in demand coming from the rest of the world, does this challenge the framing that what we're seeing with the end of COVID-19 restrictions today in China is primarily a China story?
Yeah, that's a very, very important question. So first of all, you know, the sector that saw the most amount of weakness, not surprisingly, was the Chinese property market, which we know has been struggling throughout the course of last year, starting from, as a matter of fact, in China Beigebook data, really the property downturn began all the way back in April, May of 2022. Obviously, the Evergrande crisis that came up in the fall of 2021 is seen as sort of that watershed moment where the implosion happens. But the weakness, and pretty serious weakness, had begun months before Evergrande collapse ultimately happened. But nevertheless, talking about the fourth quarter and the end of last year, the property sector was in deep trouble. You know, you see the residential market in a severe contraction and getting worse. You see the commercial real estate side of the property market also in a contraction, and you don't naturally see any type of infrastructure development or fiscal stimulus really that would have counteracted any of that weakness. So the property market hands down in a deeper hole at the end of the year than it had been throughout any period that year, you know, early in 2022, in any period earlier in 2022. So you've got that problem that you're dealing with. Outside of the property market, which we're all well aware of at this point, even through other sort of news stories and so forth that we hear, manufacturing struggled quite a lot. And that is a very seriously alarming sign. Because again, as we said, well aware of the fact that the property market has a very serious crisis. But what we are now seeing is that the export-driven sector of the economy, and due to, by the way, weakness in exports, which, you know, earlier were lackluster through early part of the fall, summer were lackluster. Now they're just falling, they're down. And that weakness is starting to set in, which tells you that the global demand slowdown is here already. It's showing up in Chinese export orders. And so manufacturing weakness was the thing that really alarmed us. And it alarmed us because as we talk about the Chinese recovery, we have to remember that the manufacturing sector is a very important driver of growth in China. And if you see continued downturn there, it's going to really cap the upside when we talk about the recovery of the Chinese economy and we talk about how much improvement we can get in 2023. And that's linked to many other things that, you know, commodities and so forth that I'm sure we'll talk about. So a lot of the weakness is naturally over there. That's the bulk of the weakness. Again, everything looked bad when you lock people down for 2 months and then you say all of a sudden about face, in a hazard manner, you open everything up and COVID starts spreading like wildfire. Naturally, the consumption sectors are going to be hurting. And they were, whether it was hospitality, whether it was restaurants and so forth.
What do we know about where things stand with COVID right now in China?
Look, I mean, you know, we saw what happened in the major cities with the massive spread of COVID. The idea is that we've gone over at least the first wave. We've kind of peaked, if you will, in the major cities. And now what we're seeing is either maybe starting to reach the top of the peak in some parts of the rural areas and other parts we're yet to hit there. But, you know, we saw that massive COVID spread in the big cities and now we're seeing it in the rural areas. The rural areas are obviously much more disadvantaged to deal with this. Lack of medical facilities by comparison to major cities, lack of medication. There's a lot of news that's coming out right now where folks are resorting to all sorts of home remedies and so forth in order to deal with the disease, which obviously requires very serious therapeutics and antivirals and so forth, which people just do not have access to. So I think we're seeing a pretty serious amount of destruction take place at the human level in the rural areas after we saw the massive spike in deaths and so forth. Unacknowledged they went, of course, officially, but nevertheless, it was very clear what was going on in the major cities and the human toll of this.
Is there any sense of how the human toll and the adverse economic effects this time around compare to those during the initial COVID spike in the fall and early spring of 2019, 2020?
I think this time is absolutely going to be much worse, and it's already looking much worse because what happened at the beginning of COVID when this came out is that, you know, you saw the Communist Party kind of resort to what I say is their standard approach towards dealing with epidemics, which is that you impose lockdowns and quarantines and you quarantine people who have been infected. I myself, as a matter of fact, happened to be in China when the swine flu virus was the big threat. And I have firsthand experience going through being picked up by the Ministry of Health officials, being transported to a quarantine facility, being moved from one quarantine facility to another. And I have to tell you, when it happens, you know, when you're not expecting it, of course, it's jarring and a little scary. But in less than 24 hours of us being around other people, our group and these people who were, quite frankly, complete random people to us and strangers at restaurants and in the bus, I saw a lot of those same folks at the same quarantine facility as myself. So the government has a remarkable ability to just round people up and impose these sorts of quarantine measures and lockdown measures and so forth. And that's what they resorted to at the beginning, which I think saved a lot of people's lives at that point. Now, of course, the next 2 years should have been spent preparing to deal with COVID and not just resorting to lockdowns over and over again. But this time around, the government, you know, again, vaccinations, mRNA vaccines, they're still not there. Antivirals, they're in incredible short supply, basically not available to the majority of the population. And so there is a very serious health crisis and people are dying, just to put it very simply.
So we don't know, and we're not going to know for a very long time with any degree of certainty what the long-term implications of COVID are on people's health and on the population writ large. Having said that, do we have any sense, or is there any speculation or conversations in China or among analysts like you about what the long-term demographic challenges that China's economy may face as a result of COVID-19 are going to be. And I say that particularly because we know now that 2022 officially was the first year in how many years that China's population actually contracted?
Yeah, I think, you know, the demographic question comes up all the time in China-based conversations. And we will see what the impact is, because I think it's becoming clear that naturally, just the way it happened here in the United States and I believe elsewhere, the elderly population is naturally disproportionately affected when it comes to getting COVID and dying as a result of COVID. So we'll see. The reality is, again, we won't know how many million will be recorded in the death toll. And I suppose it'll never actually be officially recorded because it's not accepted as dying from COVID. But given the new definitions out in China, even if you do die from COVID, it's not accepted as such. So, you know, we'll see what the longer term impacts are just specifically because of this disease. But as you said, there is a larger demographic challenge facing China, and that is that you've got that graying population, you've got the young population, which is, of course, your working population ultimately, is shrinking, and it creates all sorts of challenges where you have a fewer and fewer number of younger people who will have to support a larger and growing number of older citizens. And, you know, that has all sorts of implications from a wealth accumulation and becoming rich as a country. That, you know, that's the real thing. Everybody always says, will China go the way of Japan? And the answer that you'll often hear is, well, you know, Japan got rich. China may ultimately get old before it gets rich. And that creates a whole different set of outlooks then for the strength of the Chinese economy and the long-term trajectory of the Chinese economy, just from that demographic factor alone. There are many other structural things to discuss naturally. So that's sort of the view that we also share in-house.
When I started learning about China's economy years ago, I remember this being a concern even then, something that people talked about, the fear that China is going to grow old before it grows rich, that it's not going to be able to escape the middle income trap. Is this just as much a concern today as it was then? Is it more of a concern? Because I don't hear about it as much anymore. Maybe that's just me because I'm either desensitized to it or I don't know.
No, I think it is very much a concern. I think, as a matter of fact, the recent census data have put it at the top of the list once again that people are discussing. And even as other factors become more of a, you know, sort of rise to the top, this will remain a long-term and ongoing concern. And, you know, this is really tied into ultimately, I think, by and large, a conversation about the Chinese economic model. Right? How is China planning to grow its economy in a manner that is both sustainable, but also creates wealth and opportunities for more and more people? Because what we do know is that the current China model that we've all been used to, which was a model where high rises are going up at lightning speed and bridges are being built to nowhere, and China's the factory of the world. And it's, you know, it's an investment-driven model, which of course we know eventually meant high levels of debt getting accumulated, serious debt challenges happening in the economy, and so forth. That model has really run out of road, right? China cannot afford to rely on that anymore. So the question is, what happens next? How do you turn that economy into one that's driven by consumer spending and all of that? And I think that'll go a long way in answering the question of this old versus rich and so forth.
Yeah, I feel like that's what makes this a uniquely complicated and difficult picture to paint or to understand, which is that besides all the exogenous or endogenous but not policy-driven economic challenges that China faces, just like every other economy, they also have this very hands-on, bureaucratic, top-down-driven economic model with specific policy objectives. And in this case, the Chinese government has made it its official policy, and this is especially true under Xi Jinping, that they want to reorient the economy towards a more sustainable but also somewhat equitable footing. And this involves raising domestic consumption and on a relative basis and lowering dependence on export markets. This, of course, is necessary also to achieve some of their geopolitical aims and their aims to decouple long-term from the U.S. dollar, which requires, again, the Chinese domestic market being stronger. I think actually that there's going to be an opportunity for us to discuss that. I have one more question with respect to COVID before we move on from that. And this is, might be an unfair question or not one that you're in a position to answer, but I don't know what the health of people in China is. Like, you know, Americans are, we have a lot of obese people, and obesity is a huge risk factor for COVID, which we've learned since the early days of the pandemic, when a lot of us thought that it was a respiratory disease, or the media was saying it was a respiratory disease. And there was a lot of fear that China's population would be uniquely vulnerable to it because there are many more people smoke in China than they do, let's say, in the US and Europe. It's turned out to be an endothelial disease. And so people with obesity or who are overweight present significant risk factors. Do we know anything about the risk factors of the Chinese population and how susceptible they are to COVID, long COVID symptoms relative to Westerners?
You know, I think, you know, the medical community and is probably best positioned to answer that in a more scientific way. But let me, from the economic and political economy angle, make one point, which I think often gets lost in any conversation about China. I think it's important to remember that when you leave, you know, Shanghai and Guangdong or any of these big cities with their massive skyscrapers, you know, China is a very poor country still, and it's a developing country, and it suffers from the same challenges on the health front, including the education front and other and access fronts that many developing countries do. So I think, you know, that goes a long way to saying, which comes takes me back to my original point, that a lot of your folks in the rural areas and a lot of your migrant workers who live in these major cities, but they are essentially second-class citizens because of their residential status, their cards, ID cards essentially is the simplest way to explain it in English. They do not have the ability to access the facilities in these major cities, neither do their families, that people who actually belong, who are residents of that area do. So there is that wide income disparity, there is that inequality, which can, you know, I think one can reasonably assume means that a vast majority of the Chinese population's health is probably not that great when you think about the income disparity, when you think about the lack of access. So let me maybe sort of, you know, just leave it at that. The stats are probably not that great, and the doctors could probably build a stronger case for that than I can.
So the last time the world went into a major economic contraction, China, you know, quote, saved the day with huge stimulus efforts. Was their growth, remind me, was it like 15% GDP growth around that time as a result in 2009?
It was something like that. And, you know, I mean, double-digit growth for China through much of 2010s was just something we took for granted. And many folks thought this was going to be it for a very long time.
So when was the last time that China engaged in widespread stimulus efforts? And do you expect us to see anything like that today, given the fact that they have these policy objectives, which are to reorient and pivot, so to speak, economic growth from relying heavily on exports to being more balanced or more consumer oriented in the long term?
You know, what happened in the aftermath of the great financial crisis, as you just said, was China just unleashed a multi-year stimulus program. And that's really where a lot of that debt accumulation we referenced earlier came from. And then therefore, obviously, became a very serious economic problem. But that also led to that booming double-digit growth that we were also used to for so many years coming out of China. Over the course of that 2010s period and so forth, you know, we saw various other bouts of stimulus take place. For example, when the economy went through a sort of a mini recession, if you will, end of 2015 is when it started in China Beigebook data. It became pretty obvious in other data in early 2016. You saw some amounts of stimulus there. The property market went through a downturn through 2016. I believe it was late 2016, parts of 2017. You saw recovery and stimulus measures take place there. The most interesting and remarkable thing of what happened in 2021 was that you didn't see that kind of stimulus come back. And in 2022, you didn't see that kind of stimulus take place. And especially after COVID, especially as we got into a couple of years ago now in 2021, this really caught China watchers off guard, because the whole idea was that China staged this remarkable V-shaped recovery in the aftermath of the COVID downturn. It was obviously led by industrial sector, led by the manufacturing sector. Western economies were, you know, sending checks left and right, and folks were just buying up everything they possibly could. So Chinese factories were booming at this because of that. And now the recovery was going to extend from the manufacturing and the industrial side of the economy to the consumer side of the economy. The Chinese consumers were going to be next. And you were going to get this powerful growth comeback story in 2021. That didn't happen.
Because of COVID? How much of that was driven by COVID?
I think a lot of that was driven by COVID. It was driven by the fact that there was actually a lot of macroeconomic uncertainty, and Chinese consumers weren't just going to go start blending and splurging left and right when a chunk of that year, 2020, had been spent in a very serious downturn and labor market and unemployment was rising. Now, this wasn't available in the official data, and I can maybe tell you that story later for the audience. Yeah, the data were completely manipulated in 2020. They made it look like growth was better than 2019, but it wasn't. And the Chinese consumers very ultimately made it clear that they weren't going to go out there and spend and so forth. But the expectation became then that, oh, we are going to get a big stimulus push from the PBOC because the consumers aren't getting activated and manufacturing growth is starting to slow down now a little bit, and the economy needs an injection of capital. And that never happened. And this was, and you know, I mean, Wall Street analysts, et cetera, everybody was flabbergasted, but we kept saying, look, it's not happening. It's not going to happen. It's nowhere being seen in the China Beigebook data. And the reason it's not happening is because the policy planners understand that that old model is no longer working. That old China growth playbook that, you know, all the China watchers and the banks that put out their research reports have been so used to is just no longer, it wasn't working and it's out the window. And since then, you've seen that the stimulus measures have been incredibly muted. All through the course of 2021, especially through the course of 2022, you didn't get that big bang fiscal stimulus for sure. You didn't get the monetary stimulus. Now that sets up 2023, of course, for an interesting time, because now finally, if zero COVID is gone, you can actually do stimulus, because you can't stimulate an economy if you're going to shut it down every 2.5 months, or important parts of it at least. So that's the big story, though. That growth playbook has indeed changed. The thinking around the Chinese economy by the policy planners has absolutely changed. And so China watchers need to update their models and update the way they think about the response, the policy response there when economic downturns take place.
Do we have some sense of how strong the demand for credit growth is in China and where that demand is coming from?
Look, I mean, you know, when you track thousands and thousands of companies, one of the clearest things you can walk away with, as we do, is who wants credit, who is getting credit, who isn't getting it, and of course, people who are getting it, companies that are getting it, how expensive is it for them and who's got preferential access versus not? One of the standard things that you see is that your private companies, your SMEs, almost always, and especially these SMEs.
Small and medium-sized enterprises, for those who don't know the term.
Exactly. The part of the economy that you hear a lot of pledges being made to in the press conferences, which is supposed to represent the future of the Chinese economy, because they're more services-driven. They're the parts of the company that are not part of the industrial model, which is largely state-led, large firm-led. They are almost always left out in the cold. They don't have access to credit, even though there's a lot of demand for that. And when they do get access to credit, they pay astronomical rates compared to large firms. So yeah, that, you know, there is a mechanism that we've created, which is exactly what you said, to track credit demand in China. And if I can add one more point, you know, what we saw throughout 2022 was that not through much of 2022 and 20, you know, the year before that, was that not only was there not a lot of stimulus taking place from the supply side, companies themselves were pent-up demand was almost consistently falling because of COVID. They were getting shut down, which meant that they had no incentive to invest. They had no incentive to hire, which also meant that short of needing credit to, you know, do things like for cash flow purposes, paying invoices and workers and so forth, you didn't really need to take out that many loans because you weren't going to do anything with them. So that's been a very fantastic thing to have been tracking now. Now that's changing, but we'll see how far it goes this year.
How has the nature of lending in China changed, and specifically between bank sector lending versus non-bank lending, and what's the significance of that?
Yeah, that's a very, very important thing, you know, that we look at. In our latest numbers over the course of the fourth quarter, we saw shadow lending just explode. As a matter of fact, it exploded to the highest level we've seen in over 10 years of tracking the Chinese economy. And that was very concerning because it told us that credit demand is certainly returning among companies, but the banks clearly are either unable or most likely unwilling to lend to a lot of these firms. And so companies are having to resort to non-bank lenders, such as, whether they be other companies, other individuals and trust companies and so forth, typically institutions and lenders that the government over the last 5 to 6 years has really tried to go after and really fight back. So right now you're getting a lot of the non-formal side of the economy, the shadow side of the economy, the non-bank lenders being in, at least in the end of the year, were the primary credit provider or a big chunk of the credit suppliers, if you will.
So does that mean that there's more lending happening to distressed companies as opposed to companies looking or companies that have good economic opportunities to invest in? I mean, is there some sense of that? And how does that show up as the cost of credit? Is credit more expensive to get in China as a result of that for these companies?
Yeah, because of when you talk about these companies and their conditions, they're pretty bad, right? If they're showing declining profit margins, if they're complaining about weaker sales, if they're talking about losing pricing power month after month, quarter after quarter, when the economy as a whole is doing very poorly as it was, therefore, obviously, these companies are doing very poorly, you have two factors going on at the same time. A, it seems like now a lot of these firms who are going out there and trying to get credit, they're desperate. They need the money. And number two, that banks are unwilling to lend to these firms that may very well go bust or maybe are unable to repay their loans. They might as well stick with their safer clients or clients such as state-owned companies and so forth. So those are the two problems that you're currently seeing happen. And of course, the third factor which makes this more burdensome on these companies that are already doing quite poorly is that they're resorting to shadow lenders that are far more expensive than the banks, that are charging a premium and a pretty large premium by comparison. So when you track interest rates in China Beigebook data, you see that firms that borrowed from non-bank lenders paid astronomical prices and much higher prices than those companies that managed to get loans from banks.
So this kind of makes me think of something we mentioned earlier. I think you brought up the comparison to Japan. And I don't remember what the context was. It might have been, can China's economy avoid the, it was in the context of getting old before they get rich.
Right.
The Japanese struggled throughout the 1990s and the 2000s, in part because of this, not just demographics, but also this debt overhang. And one of the criticisms was that much of the capital went towards refinancing zombie companies as opposed to financing new investments that could long-term increase productivity and growth. I mean, when I look at China's economic situation, it seems, I mean, again, I don't want to go over my skis here. I think because of China's unique relationship to governing authority and legitimacy and GDP targets as being a source of legitimacy and growth, they seem to be particularly invested in maintaining growth. And that isn't necessarily consistent with working out the rot and going through the type of really tough business cycle that you would need to in order to get onto a more sustainable path for growth. How do you think about that long term in terms of the debt overhang in China and how they can conceivably manage that and what that means for growth in the rest of the world and for commodity prices?
Yeah, that's the longer term issue that needs to be worked out. Why is it that you typically don't get financial crises in a place like China, or you haven't at least, even though so many folks have been predicting that hard landing would take place? You didn't because the government consistently is able to socialize the losses. What does that mean? It's just able to create these facilities where one bank lends to the indebted firm, the indebted firm's bad debts get sucked up by an asset management company, and you just kind of keep on getting that recycling process going. What that really means, of course, is what are you doing? You're taking good money and you're constantly throwing it after bad money. And this has gone on for a very long time. Now, you've seen some of that happen again in the aftermath of the property crisis at a smaller level, where you've seen these asset management firms once again, which have been created to take over a lot of the bad debt. And you are seeing some of that recycling going on. However, I think what's interesting this time is that the property sector bailout isn't a sector-wide bailout. As a matter of fact, technically, it's not even a property sector bailout. It is a very targeted approach to make sure that some of these healthier companies that have had to increasingly take on the projects of companies that have gone bust or are on the verge of having done so and have defaulted on a lot of their debt, these larger firms don't drown because they've now all of a sudden become responsible both for the projects and at times for the debt of these companies that are on the verge of going under or have gone under. It is meant to provide them with financing facilities that they can resort to and to make sure that they're able to kind of complete these various residential complexes, apartments, homes, et cetera, and ultimately have them provided to customers or be able to sell them. So that is, again, to a small degree, the same things taking place. You are having to use good money to cover for the problems and throw it towards bad money, throw it after bad money. But that, you know, it is much more targeted. Now, we'll see if this is the trajectory upon which the economy continues. Do we see sort of Beijing taking a harder and harder line and maintaining this stance? So that is the big question mark. That, of course, ties into a lot of things. And again, let's stay with the property market because we're talking about commodities. You know, a lot of, I think, bullishness. And the bottom line, as I like to say, is that, you know, the 2023 China commodities story cannot be, and it shouldn't be, a story of bears versus bulls. There's really, quite frankly, no reason to be bearish. It's become a story of bulls versus mega bulls. You've got the mega bulls who expect that we're going to get record oil demand, we're going to get record demand for iron ore and copper because there's going to be a building spree and and all the factories are going to be running at the highest gear possible, and there's going to be this boom this year in consumer and travel, which is ultimately going to, you know, be this big, powerful, positive story for commodities. And my view there is that we're going to get a very good year compared especially to 2022. But I think we need to be very mindful of what the risks are, and we need to be very mindful of what's going on. I think, do we get fiscal stimulus this year? Again, do we get the government spending money? Maybe eventually we start to see that. Do we need a massive fiscal stimulus this year, or the PBOC decides to keep it in its back pocket for next year when some of that consumer-driven demand starts to perhaps die off, or you need it in the face of slowing manufacturing sector? So these questions need to be evaluated a lot more seriously and need to be tracked in the data. We've launched a fiscal stimulus index, and we're not seeing a massive jump in it. We saw a bit of a rise in it, but we're going to be keeping a close eye. We have a fiscal activity index, which was absolutely in contraction, as I mentioned earlier. We have a monetary stimulus index, which is starting to perk up a little bit, but it's nowhere near old levels that we've seen it in the past. So these are the data points that we need to track as we think about that commodities comeback story also.
So this is what I want to start the second part of our conversation with, Shahzad, the bull versus mega bull story, 2022 versus 2023, the risks, as you mentioned. Oil has been one of the more volatile commodities. I mean, in general, it's more volatile than many because of how sensitive it is to the economic cycle. But in particular, I think one of the things that we've seen is this push and pull between the supply-driven narratives and demand-driven narratives. And the demand side is obviously much more uncertain and depends heavily on China and the fate of the Chinese economy. Other commodities, some copper, iron ore, these are some of the things I want to talk about. I also want to discuss what you guys are seeing on the ground with respect to companies moving supply chains from China or diversifying away from China. We've seen that in the case of Apple. And of course, I also want to talk about the impact of some of these export controls, in particular on semiconductors, on China's economy. Maybe it's too early to know, but that's another question that I want to ask you, Shahzad. For anyone who is new to the program, Hidden Forces is listener supported. We don't accept advertisers or commercial sponsors. The entire show is funded from top to bottom by listeners like you. If you want access to the second hour of today's conversation with Shahzad, head over to hiddenforces.io/subscribe and sign up to one of our three content tiers. All subscribers gain access to our premium feed, which you can use to listen to the rest of today's conversation on your mobile device using your favorite podcast app, just like you're listening to this episode right now. Shahzad, stick around. We're going to move the second part of our conversation onto the premium feed.
Sounds good.
If you want to listen in on the rest of today's conversation, head over to hiddenforces.io/subscribe and join our premium feed. If you want to join in on the conversation and become a member of the Hidden Forces Genius community, you can also do that through our subscriber page. Today's episode was produced by me and edited by Stylianos Nikolaou. For more episodes, you can check out our website at hiddenforces.io. You can follow me on Twitter at Kofinas, and you can email me at info@hiddenforces.io. As always, thanks for listening. We'll see you next time.